people who work constantly ceaselessly for fruitive goals with no adherence to scriptural principles. Is that enough for them? Do you want more about movements?
What animal are they compared to?
They're compared to beasts of burden.
Yeah, right.
They carry things all day long. Really don't even know how horrible their situation is.
One of the characteristic features of the Buddha, even after working so hard, they don't enjoy sense gratification. The typical Buddha, they work very hard, but even so, he says, to such Buddhas, material gains, which are destructive of their lives all in all, despite the fact that the Buddhas enjoy only a very small fraction of the fruit of labor. Sometimes they spend sleepless days and nights for fruitive gain, and although they may have ulcers or indigestion, they are satisfied with practically no food, etc. A typical Buddha will work very hard to have a very nice house with pretty lawn, swimming pool in the back, and has to work two jobs, so he's never at home. So what he gets is the mental satisfaction that I have a nice house, which he rarely ever enjoys. Okay, next.
Next is Naradavas.
Yeah.
Which are the lowest of mankind.
Naradama. What are the distinguishing characteristics of Naradamas? Here it is. Those who are socially and politically developed but who have no religious principles must be considered Naradamas. People of whom a higher standard is expected. In other words, they're not aborigines, but they act worse than aborigines. So that's what people, those who are socially, that's 386, it's defined like that very clearly. He talks about this human species, the uncivilized and the civilized who have regular principles of social, political, and religious life. Those who are socially and politically developed but have no religious principles. These are Naradamas.
Does that mean any religious principles?
Any religious principles. They don't observe any religious principles.
Just have not agnostic.
Yeah, just to ignore the lip service. Things like that. Typical Naradamas were Jagai and Madai, especially because they were Brahmanas by birth, but they fell down to the position of drunkards. Next class?
Maya Pratigyana?
Yeah. The?
Those are the?
Maya Pratigyana.
The mental speculators.
What does Mayaya Aparita Jnana mean?
Those whose knowledge is stolen by religion.
Right.
So they think that they are really erudite and knowledgeable and they speculate on many things, but they don't follow the scriptural principles and thus their speculation is useless.
Prabhupada focuses in on those Mayaparita Jnanas as those who offer unauthorized commentation on the Bhagavad Gita. And in the final class of Duskriti?
Asuram Bhavam Asuritam?
Yeah. Asuram, not Asuritam. What did you say?
I said Asuram.
Asuram? Yeah. Bhava Ashrita.
Those are the atheists. Those are atheistic people.
Yeah, do you know what Asura, Bhava, Ashwita? Here's that word Bhava again, meaning nature. Those who are accepted from my natures. As you say, who partake of the atheistic nature of demons, Asura, Bhava. The atheistic nature of demons.
Would that be a subcategory of Nirvana?
Yeah. All of the others can be subcategories of Nirvana. These are not necessarily exclusive. Any questions on these? Or well-known types? Next, in text 16, we go to the Sukritina, the do-gooders, well-doers, not only for the pious, Sukriti. Four kinds of pious. Anybody care to just do what Suchi did for the impious, for the pious? You always know the bad guys better than you know the good guys. Why is that?
Maybe you can identify them.
More interesting. Mark Twain said, heaven for climate, hell for society. That's not our philosophy. Yeah? You want to do it?
Okay. First group are those who are material stressed. So they're seeking some sort of solution to that. And then there's those people who desire wealth.
Yeah, to the Sanskrit artha, artha. And then the seeker of wealth, artha, that's with a short A, the TH, artha, arti. Artha, arti, the seeker of wealth. Artha, and artha, artha, and Arta and Artha Arti. Get that aspirate in there. Okay. The one who desires material gain. But, okay, go ahead. And then?
And then there's the inquisitive, which are different from the last group, which are
the Jnanis. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Inquisitive Jnanasu. And the Gyanis. So these fall into two, they're devotees. What makes them pious? Prabhupada says, what is it about these people that make them pious? Yeah, right. But what is it that makes them approach Krishna? Because a person in distress can go two different ways. Typically, people sometimes when they get in distress, why me, there is no God. And other people, when they fall into a distressed condition, they take shelter of God. What's the difference?
Doesn't have to do with past activities.
Yeah, the past pious activities. Prabhupada says here, unlike the miscreants, these are adherents of the regulative principles of the scriptures. And they are called Sukritina, or those who obey the rules and regulations of scriptures, the moral and social laws, and are more or less devoted to the Supreme Lord. So they have this tendency toward devotion. They perform the kind of devotional service that is mentioned here is called Mishra Bhakti. Mishra means mixed. And there's two groups. There's the Artha and the Artha Arti, the one in distress and the one in search of wealth. These are the Karma Mishra Bhakti, those whose devotee, whose bhakti is mixed with karma, or desire for material benefit. And the Jignasu and the Gyani, who are Jnana Mishra Bhaktas, those whose devotional service is contaminated or mixed with Jnana, the desire. Karma and Jnana. Pure devotional service is devoid of these two things, karma and Jnana. So these are mixed with karma, two mixed with Jnana. The difference between the Jignasu and the Jnani, so far as I understand it, is that the Jignasu is some person who is more or less blindly searching, trying this out, trying that out. The Jnani is one who is focused on the Absolute Truth, but due to lack of complete knowledge, has awareness or knowledge only, awareness or knowledge mostly of the impersonal aspect. Dry philosophers frustrated in every field of knowledge. Okay. Well, there may even, but they have some tendency toward devotion. So Prabhupada says this. As long as such a purified stage is not attained, devotees in transcendental service to the Lord are tainted with fruitive activities and search for mundane knowledge, etc. One has to transcend all this before coming to the stage of pure devotional service. Questions? Yeah, these are pure types.
You know, they may be inquisitive, but also in distress.
Yeah, one has to get it sometimes.
They're also kind of like a gyanitude, actually searching for the Absolute Truth.
And they're also Narada Masasura Mala Mushroom.
But just because they're a little bit pious.
Yeah.
How does someone come into Krishna consciousness which desires wealth?
Who desires wealth?
Doesn't seem like there's much more to be had.
Dr. Kamlesh. Discreet though. Any other questions?
I
don't
see any questions.
The same question.
Okay. Well, that seems sometimes. People sometimes move into the temple and they can't pay their rent anymore.
That's distress.
It's typically more distress. So now we go on. Text 17 and 18. Krishna then continues. Remember, this is all in the context of talking about that the material nature is very difficult to overcome, but those who surrender to me can easily cross beyond it. So then he talks about four who surrender and four who don't surrender. So now those that surrender, one who develops knowledge, he says. Of these, the one who is in full knowledge and who's always engaged in pure devotional service is the best. It appears that you've gone from kind of beginner, neophyte devotee, to one who's more advanced, because it's talking about always engaged in pure devotional service. For I am very dear to him, and he is dear to me. The understanding that I have here from text 17, the purport, is that of these four, the one who's actually in knowledge, or the one who's actually penetrating into the absolute truth, is the most advanced. And the others also have to come to that platform.
Jnani?
Yeah. Listen to what Prabhupada says. Free from all contaminations of material desires, the distressed, the inquisitive, the penniless, and the seeker after supreme knowledge can all become pure devotees. But out of them, he who is in knowledge of the absolute truth and free from all material desires becomes a really pure devotee of the Lord. So there's a distinction between pure devotees and really pure devotees. The Prabhupada says. And then, but in all of them all become themselves pure by association, all four. But in the preparatory stage, the man who is in full knowledge of the Supreme Lord and is at the same time executing devotional service is very dear to the Lord. So now it sounds like he's talking about he who is situated in pure knowledge of the transcendence of the Supreme Personality of God and is so protected in devotional service, material contamination cannot touch him. So at least four, there are people who actually gain early on knowledge of Krishna. They become convinced that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Janma karma chari divyam evam yogi tatvatam. That's the best. Sooner or later, everyone comes to that stage, but there's more persons who are come to that first are the best. All these devotees are undoubtedly magnanimous souls, but he who is situated in knowledge of me I consider to be just like my own self. Being engaged in my transcendental service, he is sure to attain me the highest and most perfect goal. He says, out of affection, the devotee who wants some benefit out of devotional service are accepted by the Lord because there is an exchange of affection. Out of affection, they ask the Lord for some material benefit, and when they get it, they become so satisfied that they also advance in devotional service. But the devotee in full knowledge is considered to be very dear to the Lord because his only purpose is to serve the Lord in devotion. Doesn't ask for anything. Okay. Now we come to text number 19. I think this is a text we have set aside, remember?
I think it was
17.
Yes,
it is. Huh?
It's 19.
19. Mm-hmm. Anybody have text 19 memorized? Sanskrit, English. Yes?
That's right.
Jayavana Mante, what does that mean? After many births and deaths. Successfully, but they actually develop Gana. Ganavan. They become Ganavan. But it's not an easy thing. This indicates that it is rare. Remember earlier I said it is very rare. Out of many of those who have attained perfection, many thousands, only one knows me. So it's rare. In the beginning of spiritual realization, while one is trying to give up one's attachment to materialism, there is some leaning toward impersonalism. But when one is further advanced, he can understand that there are activities in the spiritual life and that these activities constitute devotional service. Realizing this, he becomes attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and surrenders to him. At such a time, one can understand that Lord Sri Krishna's mercy is everything. Vasudeva Sarva, that Krishna's mercy is everything. That's part of the understanding. That he is the cause of all causes, and the material manifestation is not independent from him. So in this way, one sees Vasudeva Sarva Iti. Krishna is everything. So this everything in relationship with Krishna. This is such a universal vision of Vasudeva. So that's what such a person has. Universal vision. Such a universal vision. Did you hear the... I talked about this on Sunday? Yeah, the Sunday Feast lecture. Did you hear it, Mother? There. Universal vision precipitates one full surrender to the Supreme Lord. And that's been discussed already. How seeing everything in relationship to Krishna, seeing everything depending on Krishna. This universal vision precipitates one's full surrender to the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna as the highest goal. Such a great soul, Sudurlabha. Very rare. Durlabha, Sudurlabha, really Durlabha.
Can this possibly refer to the devotees who are not fully surrendered to Krishna, but after many universal deaths, they actually come to that plan?
Yeah, also that. Prabhupada, many times he applies this, especially to the Mayavadis, who at last develop Krishna consciousness.
Yeah,
because this is the next stage up, and some of that, take that. That's explained in Srimad Bhagavatam in connection with Shivadeva Goswami, who was born Brahman realized. He was Brahman realized within his mother's womb already, so he didn't bother to take birth. There's no need for him to engage in any activities. He was Atmarama. Atmarama means one who takes pleasure in the self. He was fully self-satisfied. And therefore, his mother remained pregnant for quite a few years because he wouldn't come out. So finally, he heard Vyasadeva speaking. I guess an early version of Srimad Bhagavatam. He became attracted to it. Although he was Atmarama and not attracted to anything material, he became attracted to hearing the pastimes of Krishna. So because there are many Atmaramas like that who are attracted to nothing material will become attracted to Krishna, that's evidence that Krishna's pastimes are not material but spiritual. Somebody as strict as sannyasi as Lord Chaitanya and completely free from any interest actually, you know, realized hearing about Krishna and the gopis, you can understand if you're dealing with somebody other than mundane stories. So they come, the Mayavadi, or the Brahmavadis, when they come to Krishna ultimately, when they finally become full of knowledge, not to have the vision of Krishna, even though they may be called Gyanis, means they don't have full knowledge. They don't see things. It's typical with Gyanis, they don't see things in relationship to Krishna. So let's describe the Gyana. Any questions about it?
Well, the sentence that near the end where it says, similarly, Lord Vasudeva, the personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, is the prime entity in everything. And I don't know, I was just confused by that terminology, prime entity in everything, because if there's, let's say, this body, there's me, you know, Jiva soul, and then there's this super soul, Krishna. And what, how, where does that leave the Jiva soul?
Secondary entity. Because it's first of all Krishna. The soul, because he's sustaining everything, including the jiva. He's the life of all that lives. Jivana, sarva-bhutana. So as you explained, he's the sustaining principle. And so anything that's going on, everything that's going on is because of this entity. Here he says, oh yeah, in this body there are powers of speaking, of seeing, of hearing, of mental activities, but they are not important, not related to the Supreme Lord. All these powers are working in relationship to the Supreme Lord. They have to be consciously related that way. So he's the first. We don't see without his seeing first. We don't hear without his hearing first. We don't think without his thinking first. He's the background, the constant factor in everything. So a devotee, by virtue of knowledge, sees the Vasudeva factor. The word Vasudeva is particularly used because it refers to the Lord's all-pervading feature. Okay? Suji?
Was Vasudeva on the earth at the same time that Krishna was? I mean,
well, Vasudeva is another also. Another name for Krishna. There is Vasudeva, the Vishnu expansion. Krishna, the super soul. And there's Vasudeva, which means the son of Vasudeva. Krishna's father was Vasudeva. Vasudeva and Devaki, not Nanda and Yashoda. They're his foster parents, for his real father, biological parent. Anyway, his first father is Vasudeva. So the way of forming a patronymic is you lengthen or strengthen the first vowel, Vasudeva, Vasudeva. Just as Namaste, Sarasvata. Pat Prabhupada's patronymic is Sarasvata, derived from Sarasvati, son of Sarasvati. But these are the patronymic. Son of Pritha, that's a matronymic, same thing, Partha. Pritha becomes Partha. So. that this is Krishna's patronymic. We don't have patronymics in English. Other people have Russians. So that's also refers, that also denotes Krishna.
But is he the same one as Vyasadeva?
No, Vyasadeva is different. That's V-Y-A-S. That's Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasadeva. Vyas, V-Y-A-S. Vyas means editor.
He's an extent. He's Krishna too, though, isn't he?
Yeah.
He was there at the same time, wasn't
he? Yes, he was. I see. Vyasadeva was there at the same time, yes. So was Balaram for that matter. There was a number of
What about the Vasudeva expansion from Balaram? Vasudeva
this is Vasudeva.
That's that Vasudeva?
Yeah, that's that Vasudeva. That's Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasadeva. Dvaipayana means born from the island of Vipas. Island born, born in the island. He has some other names too. It's also called Mahamuni, great sage. Okay? Vasudeva and Vyasadeva mixed up. Text 20. This is a new section, 20 through 27, in which it is discussed. Having discussed those that surrender to Krishna and become full of knowledge, now it discusses the ignorant. So this begins with the jnana. Kamas das dai ritta jnana. The other is jnanavan. This is ritta jnana. Jnanavan professing knowledge. These are people that are deprived of knowledge. Kamas das dai by means of kam, lust. And prapadyante, same word as the last verse, prapadyante. This is prapadyante. They surrender. Anya devata, to other gods, demigods, not to me. Those who have knowledge surrender unto me, saying Vasudeva is everything, but those whose minds are disturbed by material desires, they rule narrow-minded people, they surrender to Anya devata, not to the absolute truth, Krishna, but to restricted entities. He says, they follow niyama, the particular rules and regulations of worship according to their own natures, as they are controlled prakritya, by their own natures. So, this explains why people worship demigods. Why they worship the demigods. There because their minds are distorted by material desires. Another question is, in this connection, where do they get this idea of demigod worship from?
From Krishna's.
From who?
Krishna.
Okay. How did they get it from Krishna?
Because it's super soft directs towards the demigods because that's their desire.
Yeah, well, it's true. Well, the Vedas really, first of all, that's where the instructions are to worship the different demigods. It tells you how to do it, what's the procedure, niyama, what the rules and regulations. The rules and regulations for worshiping. Excuse me, I ate just recommend demigod worship. If Krishna is God, everybody should worship Krishna. Why do they just recommend demigod worship? Someday when you're out preaching, somebody's going to ask you this question.
Someone with immaterial desires isn't going to want so much to surrender to Krishna. But for the demigods who can fulfill material desires, you follow scriptural principles while doing that, you can gradually purify yourself because demigod worship is, you know, instigated by Krishna. Mm-hmm. So it's a slow way, but it's better than defying the lotus principle. Mm-hmm.
Because in Vedic literature there are recommendations for worshipping different gods for different purposes, those who are not devotees of the Lord think that for certain purposes demigods are better than the Supreme Lord. And they're more interested in their certain material desires of certain purposes. So the Vedas direct them to surrender to various demigods. Narrow specialists in various affairs. So these are people who are really so materialistic, they won't actually approach the Supreme Lord. So anyway, they're by being directed to follow rules and regulations according to scriptures, at least in that way, indirectly, they're following, worshiping the Supreme Lord, and they're following, at least they recognize or respect a higher authority. They recognize that what they get depends on the will of somebody else. They don't know ultimately whose will it is, but at least they know somebody is doing it.
It seems like part of the problem in preaching to our Hindu congregational members of our is they think of worship as a kind of like an altar set up, but they also like to worship Krishna also.
They
worship as they worship Krishna, they just kind of clump it all together.
Yeah. They worship Krishna as a demigod also. They worship him the same as a demigod. They don't see any categorical difference between the demigods and Krishna. They see Vishnu as another demigod. They understand he's the absolute truth and the others aren't.
Sometimes it's very hard to preach to them because they're conditioned for so long, the families have done it.
Yeah, sure. Sure. I think the most effective thing is just to really drill into their heads with the Bhagavad Gita says. I don't try to preach to them, what do I know? But what Krishna says is pretty devastating. With the jnana. Here's the jnana. They all respect jnana. So here's jnana. Mam prapadyate. And he has heard the gyan, papadyante anyadevata. That's it. It's great. You can sit and blast their objects of worship with a completely pure conscience because you just confused them. Not really their objects of worship, but they're. Somewhere Prabhupada has in purport, he says, demigod worship is. Well, what's Krishna's attitude toward demigod worship? What's his judgment about it? What does he think of it? Yeah, the people that do it are less intelligent. What is the... Why are they less intelligent? Yeah, they're temporary. There's a pain that illustrates that too. You see these Grecian-type people here in the film world being loved by skeletons and black goods to illustrate that their fruits are limited.
My point is that there's a very strong cultural conditioning there.
Yeah, of course, yeah, sure. That's right. There is.
When they hear preaching like that, it's like, well, they have to accept it ultimately.
Yeah, well, you know, either they believe the Bhagavad Gita or they don't. No one Jeff to pull out the Shaiva Siddhanta or something and preach to me from that. I keep waiting if someone's going to tell me some text that says that something. Nobody's done it. And the thing is that they're, even though they may be engaged in different demigod worship, they don't really believe in them either. They ultimately are Mayavadis. And actually, for most Indians now, I have to, like when I was at that last engagement, I was having to defend demigods to somebody, some Indian gentleman. Do you really believe there's demigods? He learned all this stuff when he was a kid, but now he's a modernist. He doesn't believe in anything. Maintain the cultural level of John Lennon. Now, Krishna's judgment of demigod worshipper. Then of course he describes how he is in everyone's heart as the super soul. As soon as one desires to worship some demigod and make his face steady so that he can devote himself. Or here in the purport, Prabhupada gives the answer to this important question. Why does Krishna allow his parts and parcels to come into the material world and therefore suffer? Another all-time favorite question. Yes, no.
Because if he didn't, there wouldn't be any meaning to independence.
Yeah, that's right. It's basically it. God has given independence to everyone. Therefore, if a person desires to have material enjoyment and want very sincerely to have such facilities from the material demigods, the Supreme Lord gives him facility. He does not, as the Supreme Father of all living entities, he does not interfere with their independence, but gives all facilities so they can fulfill their material desires. Some may ask why the all-powerful God gives facilities to the living entities for enjoying this material world, and so lets them fall into the trap of the illusory energy. Some may ask that. The answer is that if the Supreme Lord, as Super Soul, does not give such facilities, then there is no meaning to independence. Therefore, he gives everyone full independence, whatever one likes, but his ultimate instruction we find in the Bhagavad Gita, one should give up all other engagements and fully surrender unto him. That will make man happy. Of course, in the rest of the purport, it goes on to say that one is dependent. You have to understand what sense one is independent, what sense one is dependent. So he describes that he makes the worshipper's faith steady so that he can worship. He gives him that power. Endowed with such a faith, he endeavors to worship a particular demigod and obtains his desires. But in actuality, these benefits are bestowed by me alone. Here in the purport of this text, 398, Prabhupada has this interesting sentences. A living entity goes to the demigod usually because he is mad to fulfill his lust. This happens when something undue is desired by the living entity and the Lord himself does not fulfill the desire. But sometimes the Lord does not personally fulfill the desires of a living entity if they're lustful or bad for him. He won't do anything bad. So therefore, he goes to the demigods. Then, text 23, Krishna's judgment. Antuvatu palamitesham tarambhava di alpamedasam. Alpamedasam means less intelligent. Those who worship the demigods are less intelligent. Why? Antavat. To palo. Their palo, fruit, the result, what they achieve, is antavat. Just as we had Ganavan, this is Vatavat, something. Antavat. It possesses an anta, an end. Adyantavanti akante, I remember that verse. Adi anta.
Hmm?
Yeah, subject to a beginning, therefore the wise man is not the lion himself. Same thing here. Antavattu palantation. But they enjoy restricted. Their fruits come to an end. Therefore, when you can, the amount of effort and worship you put in, if you worship the Supreme Lord, what you achieve would be unlimited and imperishable. Now what you get is something limited and temporary. Anyone who is after something which is limited and temporary is known as stupid. Also, the meager intelligence. Devam deva yoga.
Manifestations of Krishna are.
Okay.
First one's the taste of water. It's the original taste of water. No, not the original, just the taste of water. Then it's the, you know, this is the first text.
Yeah, okay. The taste of water.
The sun of the light and the moon.
The light of the sun and the moon.
All right.
Okay.
Then is the original sound, the om sound in the...
I don't even see something. Must be being attacked by invisible insects.
The om syllable in the...
The syllable om. Yeah. Pranava.
And then use the sound in ether.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability of that.
Right. Okay, that's five. Right. Then...
The original fragrance of the earth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The original fragrance of the earth.
It's not the next one, but the penances of the ascetics.
Yeah, that's in that verse, though.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
The penances of all ascetics.
Is the life
and
all life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, jivanam sarabhuteshu, the life in all living entities.
The light of the fire.
Hmm?
The light of the fire.
Heat.
Oh, yeah.
Heat. He tejas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one to each line. And the first verse had two in the last line, but this one in sequence is the fragrance of the earth, the heat of fire, the life of all that lives, and the penance, and all of those who perform penances. This tapas chasmi, tapas vini, tapas vishu. Penance. Okay. Now, text number 10. Where I'm looking, of course, because I have
it. It's a seed of all existence. It's a seed that everything comes.
Bijam mam sarvabhutanam vidiparta sanatana. But this vidiparta, they managed to make a whole line out of it. So vidiparta means just see, run to know all the part though, some of the that I am the bijam mam sarvabhutanam sanatanam, eternal seed, sanatanam bijam, the eternal original seed of sarvabhutanam, of all living entities, right? Then, remember?
Yeah.
Now it gets tough, yeah. Now it gets tough. Anybody happen to remember these things?
The strength of the strong
is in the next one. But you can remember the prowess. Well, first of all, buddhi and teja.
Intelligence
of buddhi madam, of those who have intelligence. Buddhi madam, the unintelligent. And teja, tejasvinam, the prowess of the powerful. Earlier, tejas meant heat of fire. But here it means prowess of the strong. Then text 11, we go down to two manifestations. And here it's strength and sex. They go together. And both of these have little riders attached to them. He is the strength of the strong, he says, that is what? Yeah, devoid of passion and desire. The strength that is of the strong, kama, raga, vibhajita, that seems to modify bhava, the strength. I am the strength of the strong, devoid of passion and desire. So the strength is not just strength, brute strength, but strength that is free from desire and passion. And then, kamosmi. Yeah. I am kama, lust, really, from sex desire, which is not contrary to religious principles. And then, finally, what's number one? The final verse has one item.
It's
the
lotus of material nature.
Well, really. Yeah. All states of beings are in me. So the last one is everything. He says, know that all states of being, whether goodness, passion, and ignorance, are manifested by my energy. So this is one thing, and it kind of includes sums and all. All are manifested by, this is the summation. In one sense, it's not, you could say there are 14 things plus a summary, but it's sort of 5, 4, 3, 2, so when you look for one. All states of being are manifestations by my energy. He is, in one sense, everything. But even though I am, they are manifesting me, I am not under them. I'm not under the modes of nature. Thus again, stating, all these things are in me, but I am not in them. The modes of nature come from him. They're manifestations of him. The divine energy, he called it, but he is, again, is aloof from the modes of nature. They don't work on him. So this is important to understand this, because Prabhupada refers to this description sometimes as a description of the impersonal feature. When you look at Krishna as he appears in material nature this way, it's usually you're looking at the impersonal feature of Krishna. And but Prabhupada makes it clear that the devotee sees it. The jnana means, for a devotee, phenomenal knowledge is different, because you see the connection with Krishna. It's not really phenomenal, although it's phenomenal in the sense that it's subject to sense perception. One sees it in relationship to Krishna. So Prabhupada says, this verse, this is the purport to 8, this verse explains how the Lord is all-pervasive by his diverse material and spiritual energies. So again, it's taking up from there of these two energies. The Supreme Lord can be preliminarily perceived. So this is the preliminary perception. This kind of meditation on the Lord in this way, through nature, is described in Srimad Bhagavatam as the first step in God realization. In the second canto, one should sit in a yogic posture and meditate upon the universal form of the Lord. And then gradually this leads ultimately to supersoul realization, because what you're looking at is the external feature of the supersoul, in a way. But if this is impersonal. The Supreme Lord can be preliminarily perceived by his different energies. And in this way, he is realized impersonally. As the demigod in the sun is a person. So of course you use this example, people are liable to argue with the example. But anyway, as the demigod in the sun is a person and is perceived by his all-pervading energy, the sunshine, so the Lord, although in his eternal abode, is perceived by his all-pervading diffusive energies. And later on he says, practically speaking, there is no conflict between personalism and impersonalism. One who knows God knows that the impersonal conception and the personal conception are simultaneously present in everything, and there is no contradiction. And it sounds like this philosophy of simultaneously oneness and difference. That is the understanding of these verses. Any questions about this enumeration? What pantheism is?
Yeah, it's Spinoza, you mentioned
him. That nature is God. The word God and the word nature are interchangeable. that means that nature is the ultimate truth, the greatest thing. That there's nothing higher and more than nature. So that, from a pantheistic point of view, what also goes along in Spinoza's is the denial of personality, the Godhead. And that the personality is there, it's only a metaphor, or something imaginative. It's a literal person. It's not part of nature, as usual pantheistic notion. I always think of the 19th century poets, Wordsworth, and these people were all, they were all pantheists, right? I can't remember who else was pantheist. It's been around for a long time.
Was it kind of like worshiping the universal form?
Yeah, that's right. Like the universe, worshiping the universal form.
So God's kind of a personal thing.
Yeah, well, the worship of the universal form has been developed pretty technically by modern philosophers like Whitehead and Hartshorne, who have actually taken 19th century pantheism and kind of developed it in a very technical way, where they think that, that actually the universe is a person. God is the cosmic organism and is a person. They describe the philosophy as not pantheism, but panentheism. Which means that God includes or transcends the world. Same idea as we have. But the God that they think of is a God that's subjected to the modes of material nature and is temporal, subjected to time. And sometimes bloops, so to speak. Struggles, fights. Evolves, is a God in evolution. Very, very modern. God in process. Growing, becoming, changing. Different idea. Somewhat. But anyway, that's. God is the cosmic organism. Anyway, this way of seeing God is usually pantheistic. Yeah.
Well, that's the only example of the sun shining, the sun glowing, the sun God.
Mm-hmm.
So how is it that as some of the realization of Brahman, karma realized is the same as going from seeing the sunshine to seeing the sun glow constantly. Seems just like you can see the sun shine and then you get closer, you see the sun glow.
You know the surface of the sun.
And how is that possible to karma realize?
Only the sense that you know more about the sun and more about the absolute truth. I mean that there's personality in paramount realization, but there's not personality in that. That's your puzzle. It's only the idea that you know more about the sun, I think. Like three successive stages of increasingly of cumulative knowledge. I think the important thing to know about that example is that it's cumulative. We know the sun's rays, and we know the sun glow, and the sun's rays, and we know the sun God, you also know the sun glow, and you know the sun planet, and you know the sun rays all together. So that these are increasing. I don't understand what your problem is.
Well, if you see this, if you come to the sun glow, but you haven't seen the sun God person, you may not realize that there is a person involved who's making all that pulses.
Right. Similarly, if you know Paramatma, you may not understand, as Prabhupada says here, what a striking statement. A fragmental part and parcel of the Lord is on page 373. Namely, the living entity may be the cause of a big skyscraper, a big factory, or even a big city, but he cannot be the cause of a big universe. The cause of the big universe is the big soul, or the super soul. Now that's where most theistic ideas end, right there. We don't go any further. Prabhupada has this sentence, and Krishna, the Supreme, is the cause of both the big and small souls. Big soul means super soul. So beyond the super soul, the source of the super soul. Similarly, in the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada discusses the cumulative realization of Brahman and super soul realization. And he says, one understands that the super soul cannot be the last word in Godhead because God must be more than merely an order supplier for human beings, for people. The idea that just God is the order supplier is not adequate to the greatness of the Supreme. Deficient idea. So there's a source also to the super soul. That is Krishna. So here in this sense, Prabhupada goes beyond. The cause of the big universe is the big soul. We're causes of little things. And there's a cause of the big universe is the big soul. But then there's a one who is the supreme, who is the cause of the big souls and the little souls.
Supersoul is not an order supplier, though, is it?
Yeah. He's supplying all desires since time immemorial. He fetches. Nitya nitya nam chetana chetana nam ego unam yoga tidatta kam. The one eternal is supplying all the desires of the many. There are two classes of eternals. One is the class by itself, the other is many. The one is supplying all the desires of the many. By virtue of super soul, you eat, you sleep, you rest. Whatever it is you've got, whatever desire you have that are satisfied, they're satisfied by the super soul.
Don't you sometimes have some desires that aren't satisfied by the super soul?
Well, it takes time. They have to be satisfied sequentially. And also he satisfies them not as much as you may desire, but as much as you deserve. The more you qualify yourself by pious activities, the more he satisfies them.
I was reading in the first canto the other day how about the incarnations, and saying the incarnations, they come through Shirdaksha Vishnu, which is the super soul. Mm-hmm. How would that work? And, you know, I see maybe Garbhadaksha Vishnu is like one entity, Garbhadaksha. Like how would it work? Seems like to me that the super soul is in everyone's heart, not every atom. So how does the incarnations like come from like an expansion of the super soul?
Well, they all are except for Krishna. Well, not Garbhadaksha.
How would you technically like think of that happening? I mean, I can see like...
I don't technically think of it happening.
They say like, from Balaram comes...
Yeah.
Balaram's a person there, but the super soul is like everywhere,
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's...
Well, he's everywhere and he's in one place also. You can't really... If you sit down and you start thinking about these things, you understand that you can't quite grab it.
I was just thinking like if it said it came from... Garbhadaksha Vishnu is in this universe, right?
Yeah.
So I could understand that a little bit because he's like kind of in one place.
Mm-hmm. Well, so is Shirdaksha Vishnu, who is the super soul. He's also in one place. But And simultaneously, he...
He has an abode, like?
Yeah, a different one.
Really?
Garbhodakshaya Vishnu is in the Mahatapa.
Yeah, right. Then Garbhodakshaya.
Garbhodakshaya is ocean in the bottom. Yes. Bottom ocean. Shiradakshaya Vishnu is in a milk ocean, localized by Kuntha planet, on an island of white sand.
It's a Vaikuntha planet?
Localized by Kuntha
planet. So there's one in each universe? Is that?
Yeah, like a franchise. Like a,
I see.
Like a real office. Same everywhere. They expand. That's probably blasphemous, isn't it?
The text of it's Jaitanya the subject of Bhava, and Bhava is translated as state of being. I've seen Bhava translated a lot of different ways. It's also described as the preliminary state of love of God. So, what is.
It also means emotion.
Emotion.
Yeah. But here, you have to know according to context.
Mm-hmm. So is it just completely different meanings, or is it?
Well, sometimes that happens. It's like the word in English, constitution. It refers to the nature of certain sorts of political documents. It also has the nature of the kind of walk you take. It's all over the place. There are a lot of words that have meanings all over the place. So Sanskrit's the same way. The word atma means soul, mind, body, according to context. You have to know. Any other questions? Okay, now we go on to the next section, which is from text 13 through 19. Now this is a real nice, important section. Krishna explains how the modes of nature. See, he ended the last section talking about how he's not under the modes of nature. And then in 13 he goes on to discuss those who are under the modes of nature. What happens to those who are under the modes of nature? And how surrendering to him frees you from the clutches of the modes of nature. Then he goes on and discusses the kinds of people who don't and the kinds of people who do surrender. And how those who surrender develop knowledge, and he describes ultimately how this knowledge develops, and one can overcome the modes, and become a Mahatma, a great soul. That's all discussed in here. And then the next section will discuss what happens to others. So here we see text 13, an important text. Deluded by the three modes, because remember the last verse, 12, ended with the referring to the three modes, sattvika, rajas, tamas, these three modes. The whole world does not know me, who am above the modes and inexhaustible. So this chapter, remember, is about knowledge of Krishna. So this is how people don't know Krishna, because they're deluded by these three modes. And so this keeps people from knowing him. And Prabhupada says in the purport, the whole world is enchanted by these modes of material nature. Those who are bewildered by these three modes, almost anyone who is under the control of these three modes, cannot understand that transcendental to this material nature is the Supreme Lord Krishna. And then he describes how this enchantment is carried out. He says, every living entity under the influence of material nature has a particular type of body, a and a particular type of psychological and biological activities accordingly. There are four classes of men functioning in the three modes of nature. So this is particularly in human society how the three modes of nature enchants us. It enchants us into becoming Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras. Because according to what the way the mode of nature is dominating us, we have this particular kind of psychological and physiological nature. And he said, by the spell of this illusory energy, we consider ourselves in terms of this bodily conception of life. That's what happens. And then you must identify yourself as one of these four. Because you'll be one of them because of whatever mode is predominating. The mode of goodness, intellectual, mode of passion, kshatriya, fighter, pilot, or whatever. mixture of passion and ignorance, vaishya, and then shudra. People sometimes wonder, it seems like if you're going to make mixtures, you could have all kinds of, why four? You know, why isn't there a separate class for the mixture of goodness and passion, like the way there is for passion and ignorance? I've never heard it explained, it's just, this is the way it is. This is the way it works out. The head, arms, belly, and legs. Sometimes people are like that. Prabhupada refers to one in the seventh canto as a verse that refers to kshatriya spirit of brahmanas. And there are different kinds of brahmanas, different kinds of kshatriyas, different kinds of vaishyas, different kinds of shudras also. It breaks down even further. But the answer is this is the arrangement of the Supreme. The Chaturvana Mayastrisham, this Chaturvana was established by me. So although maybe many of the things are possible out of three modes, to get other combinations of fives of people, five groups or whatever, by Krishna's arrangement there are four because that's what we need in the human society. So that's how we get deluded. And if we become entangled with the modes of material nature, then we forget the Supreme Personality of Godhead who is behind all these modes. So Lord Krishna says that the living entities, deluded by these three modes of nature, do not understand that behind the material background is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And specifically, if one is deluded by the mode of goodness, Prabhupada goes on to say, you cannot remember, know that either. You simply know impersonal Brahman. We will not appreciate his personal feature. Questions about that verse? So this leads us into the next verse, which is a verse that one should know in Sanskrit and in English. Anyone can render this? Gabriel, have you started memorizing yet? Okay. Anybody? So, Chi, you haven't started memorizing either, huh? Not too far ago.
Okay,
This Daivi, divine energy of mine, Gunamayi, constructed of these modes, these three gunas, Duratyaya, is very difficult. This Maya, Daivi Maya, Gunamayi, and Duratyaya, very difficult to overcome. Mam eva ye prapadyante. Now this prapadyante, this word, prapadyate, prapadyante, singular or plural, shows up a lot of times in this chapter. Surrender. But those who have surrendered to me, Paramiti, they can cross beyond it. So this is an important verse to know in the Sanskrit and English. And to know the meaning of this verse is also very important for us. And this is one of the... This is what really gives us our big break in Krishna consciousness. Why is this divine energy of Krishna consisting of the three modes of material nature difficult to overcome? Why is it so difficult to overcome this energy? Because it is controlled by Krishna. Otherwise, you see, it's matter pushing around all the time. At least we, you know, have the illusion of pushing it around. Or you ever watch ants, they pick it up, looks like they're controlling material nature. But actually they can't overcome it. Because why, even though it's dead matter, and we're superior living force, and Prabhupada says this in the purport, reading in the middle of the first paragraph, consequently his, the soul's release from the clutches of the material nature is very difficult. Even though that material nature is an inferior energy. So you may think, yeah, you got all the matter. Because material energy is, you could make the greatest cartoons of Krishna consciousness, you know. Jiva standing on the street corner saying, you know, it's matter. Because material energy is ultimately conducted by the supreme will, which the living entity cannot overcome. So if you want to overcome matter, so you have to overcome it, because so that's why it says daivihi esha guna mayi mama maya. This daivi is divine. That means Krishna's got his hand behind it. So people are trying to conquer matter. That's the effort of the scientists, is to conquer matter, but they can't. Instead, it does this flip-flop, and it conquers them. And so you get these idiots who are just, you know, sitting at Los Alamos and just blown up atomic bomb, thinking they're controlling matter, but really. Sitting there, getting all this radiation in their face, they don't know what's happening. And that matter is just, you know, taking big strides toward conquering them. And if you look in that pamphlet that Prabhupada wrote on chanting Hare Krishna, he says that the more we are under the control of the laws of the material nature, and the more we try to overcome these laws, the more we actually become, the more entangled we actually become. We get deeper entangled. The more we try to conquer nature, because people think they have this delusion, here we and there's nature out there. They don't know that human society, human bodies, human minds, well, that's also nature. So this is how one cannot overcome. Which the living entity cannot overcome, the supreme will. Inferior material nature is defined herein as divine nature due to its divine connection and movement by the divine will. So, then the second statement, but those who have surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. Why is that? Sharanagati, why is that?
Because they've surrendered unto Krishna, who's in control of it. So
he protects
the surrendered soul.
And how does he protect the surrendered soul? Specifically in his nature of their under modes of material nature, or when they're being controlled by material nature. How do they cross beyond it? What does his protection consist of? Particularly. But you're right, I just
it's
want
immunity.
Yeah, immunity. That's right. Here's how Prabhupada puts it. Devotional service, which this is the end of the second paragraph of the purport, 383. Devotional service or Krishna consciousness can help one gain such release from the bondage of material nature. Krishna, being the Lord of illusory energy, can order this insurmountable energy to release the conditioned soul. Another Krishna says, let him go. Out of the house of bondage to the promised land. He orders this release out of his causeless mercy on the surrendered soul and out of his paternal affection for the living entity, who was originally a beloved son of the Lord. So that's how he does it. He orders the material nature to release. Otherwise, in other words, unless Krishna lets you free, you don't get out. That's what this verse is saying. And this getting out, if you look at this verse in context, this is the condition of knowing and understanding Krishna. If you want to know God, you have to understand God, then you have to become free from the control of the laws of material nature. You must become free from lust, you must become free from anger, you must become free from greed, all these things. We must see they take leave of them. Whoa, but it's so much, it's so heavy. Who could overcome lust? Look how heavy it is. But if Krishna frees us, then he can keep that lust away. He can keep that greed away. He can keep that anger away. Otherwise, we'll never do it. We have to take protection of Krishna, and he'll keep these things at bay. When Maharaj Parikshit was in the womb of his mother Uttara, and Ashwatthama had sent a weapon, a guided missile, to kill Maharaj Parikshit. Ashwatthama was already known as a baby killer. He had killed the five children of Draupadi who were sleeping. He wanted to wipe out all the Pandavas. So he went for the next generation to all children. So Draupadi's five little sons were sleeping when he crept in at night, chopped them up while they were sleeping. And if that weren't bad enough, there was still one other child, Maharaj Parikshit, who was in the womb of Uttara. And her husband was Abhimanyu, who was the son of Parikshit. So this Ashwatthama released a Brahmastra, which is like a guided missile, to enter into the womb. It was very well guided. But it worked by the same principle of nuclear weapon on some kind of total combustibility of matter. He said about that mantras. So he sent this arrow to Maharaj Parikshit in the womb. So Maharaj Parikshit survived this assault because Krishna was residing there in him. He was just a fetus. Came out from within his heart and whirling the club around. The super soul has a club. Whirling the club around, dispelled the force of this Brahmastra weapon. So in that way, Maharaj Parikshit was saved. And so therefore, he saw, while still within his mother's womb, the form of the Lord. And he spent, after he was born, he spent his life looking to see again. Parikshit means examine. Looks closely and examines. He was always looking to see Krishna. So in the same way that super soul came out, just there was this atomic bomb, you know, trying to destroy Maharaj Parikshit. I mean, this weapon, which Asvatthama, by the way, couldn't control. Somebody who is adept at this, who's a good student, would have learned how to both release such a weapon and also withdraw it and control it, but actually he only half learned his lessons. He lost. And so anyway, the same way that he dispelled that, so similarly, Supasoma heart whirls his cover out and destroys lust or anger or greed. Well, Prabhupada, again, he describes this as Lord Nrisimhadeva in the heart. When we sing, Mahir Nrisimha Hridaye Nrisimha, Nrisimha is outside, Nrisimha is in my heart. We're calling upon Nrisimhadeva in our heart to take all this lust and greed and anger and destroy it the same way that he picked up Hiranyakashipu, put him in his lap, and disemboweled him. So we've got this lust and greed and anger and all these things. It's like Hiranyakashipu. So Krishna has to destroy these things from within. Then we can become free and cross over the world's material nature. Otherwise, it's insurmountable. Otherwise, it's man. There's not a self-help project. One will never make it. Any questions about that?
Yes. A technical question. In the word for word, Taranti is translated as overcome, yet the translation is cross beyond. Is there a reason for that shift?
Taranti is also... No, except that it simply doesn't make any difference. There's a submerged metaphor. In other words, the old material nature is compared to an ocean. It's difficult to cross all the time. Places of pilgrimage are called Tirtha. Tirtha means a ford. There's a place where you can cross over to the other side. Part of this, and the idea is here of this the Bhagavatam verse that says that when one surrenders to Krishna, the vast, overwhelming ocean of material nature is shrunk by Krishna to the size of water in the hoofprint of a cat. And you can step over it. So that's why this overcome and this why this cross beyond is there. Taranti is translated.